and it's KVC Arts Now on KVCR, Arts and Entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. On this edition of the program, music from and conversation with Michael Feinstein.
Each time I look at you is like the first time. Each time you're near me, the thrill is new. And there is nothing that I wouldn't do for the red light of the sight of you.
Feinstein's been bringing listeners the Great American Songbook and more for decades. Now, among that, of course, we get some Gershwin. Now, Michael, later we'll touch on Gershwin between your CDs, the book, and working with Ira Gershwin. But first, you'll be in our region quite soon with Because of You, my tribute to Tony Bennett. Are any of the tunes you're bringing songs which Tony might have gone with a small group combo for, but then it's given the big band treatment for this upcoming performance?
It's interesting about Tony. He sometimes would choose to work with a combo when he could have worked with a big orchestra. He liked the freedom of the jazz experience. And the last several times he played at the Hollywood Bowl, he chose to work with his combo as opposed to working with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. My particular show coming up in this iteration will feature a 17-piece big band. And I also do the program sometimes with a trio and sometimes with a combo. And that's very much in confluence with what Tony would do.
Beautiful. I love Tony Bennett for I couldn't tell you how many decades by now, and actually ended up with that wonderful collection, so I've probably got 18 or 20 of his discs on my shelf at home. Knowing full well that you have quite the range of singers whose material you cover, when you listen to Tony Bennett, what do you get from him? You know, and in some cases, say that which you don't get from other singers.
Tony considered himself to be a jazz singer, first and foremost, and yet he had a great reverence and respect for the melodies and lyrics that the writers created. And that's not always the case with jazz artists. And for him, it always emanated from the bones of the song. He always knew who wrote the songs and approached them from that point of view. And so there is a certain kind of connection to the songs themselves that I find very refreshing and unique to Tony, in the sense that he does have his variations on the melody, as we all do. You know, nobody is a purist. If you change one chord in the sheet music, you're not a purist.
Mm.
But he had a fundamentally different approach from other singers, I think.
I feel like he really paid attention to the lyrics in the way a storyteller would, as opposed to someone just hitting the notes. And I'm not trying to accuse any singer out there of, quote, just hitting the notes, but I really feel like Tony...
Go ahead.
Why not? I'm just an NPR guy. But it seemed like he really took the moments before putting out the phrase, and you could tell he was considering the meaning behind the lyric. No matter what it was, it felt like he was telling a story, not just singing it.
I think that's true. At his very best, he was deeply, deeply connected, and he was a storyteller. Absolutely.
My heart won't try. Yes, I may dream a million dreams, but how can they come true if there will never ever be
Well, now, one of the, I suppose, most well-known tunes, I mean, if you could state, you know, how many, 50 or 100 or whatever is associated with Tony, Rags to Riches. Okay, so I, at my age, I just may have been introduced to Rags to Riches through, hold on, Laverne and Shirley. When Carmine, you know, Eddie Mecca, he'd come belting that out whenever he'd enter a room. And so, of course, that was probably a decade and a half or two before I started getting into jazz and really appreciating Tony amongst all the other wonderful singers. Now, as a person in jazz in the NPR world, of course, now I was encountering a lot of Sinatra at the same time. I went into jazz, by the way, backwards. I started with fusion, with Stanley Clark and Return to Forever and all that kind of thing before going into the straight ahead and even older before that. So it was a rather interesting discovery of looking at Herbie Hancock backwards from the fusion down into the straight ahead to the Cantaloupe Island kind of stuff. That side note aside, you've done a lot of Sinatra. There are many, many tunes which both Sinatra and Bennett covered. Give me a tune that you think Sinatra sings but, say, Tony Bennett owns.
I Want to Be Around.
Yeah?
I Want to Be Around. Yeah, because Tony puts an intensity into it that I find, I don't know how to put it into words. I just think that his recording has a dynamism that I won't say that Sinatra does not. It's just different. Mm-hmm. Sinatra was grooving with a Basie band, and Tony has kind of a freewheeling interpretation of it. But even something like How Do You Keep the Music Playing? It was Sinatra who suggested to Tony that he record How You Keep the Music Playing. Mm-hmm. And Sinatra sang it later, and Tony did it very theatrically, in the opinion of some people, too theatrically, where he would do this sort of rabbinical ending in live performance that I thought was a little over the top. But he sang the song very slowly, with long pauses in between, and it's very different from the Sinatra recording.
Those moments of thinking about the words before putting them out there, that's, again, just comes back to that. Every time that I throw on any kind of Tony Bennett discs or albums, that's what I go back to anytime I listen to him. I think, another side note, I was fortunate to catch his daughter not too long ago, and she just put out a disc recently. And anyway, I don't know, that kind of thing sort of carried on to her as well. But that's what I find myself appreciating more and more with singers is how much interpretation, because I suppose, in all fairness, I'm a recovering theater geek, and so I'll look at lyrics differently than just the song, you know, singing a story that someone wrote about something. I think that's why I've also appreciated you. Anything that you may be performing this time around at the McCallum Theater coming up or on this tour, let's say, is there anything that you're bringing out this time that you have not recorded yet or have you not put out in previous concerts? Something that we can look at that's something new for us as a listener?
There are quite a number of songs that I include in the program that I haven't recorded and some that I haven't sung before or am doing in different arrangements this time to reflect Tony's sensibility. Inevitably, when one does a tribute to a singer as prolific as Tony, there are songs that many other singers covered. So the goal is to evoke a sense of Tony's interpretation. So I do things like The Way You Look Tonight, I do The Way You Look Tonight and Fly Me to the Moon and such. But I also do some of the lesser known things. For example, I do just at the piano Once Upon a Time by Strauss and Adams, which is a gorgeous song. And I've not recorded, and I do a pretty obscure song that Tony recorded called The Moment of Truth. So I mix those things in with the more familiar things, and in the case of something like Fly Me to the Moon, I do it as a ballad. I don't do the swing version that most people might think of, because Tony did it as a ballad. Every choice is determined by the thought of what will further tell Tony's story and put it in context. And it's a multimedia program. There's a lot of visuals and there's anecdotes. So I think it gives a very, hopefully, powerful sense of Tony's musical legacy.
Tell us then, please, about what folks can expect when they go to the McCallum to see this. I can just blanketly say I just know that it's going to be a wonderful performance. Is it going to be a little bit of, you know, not quite a lecture at all, but coming out and talking, introducing the man, and then going in some sort of almost a linear timeline? This is how we started. This is what we hit it big with, that kind of a thing. How is the presentation, please? Describe that. You already implied there's some sort of multimedia, maybe some slides, some film perhaps going on in the background.
it's a freewheeling celebration of Tony in the sense that we have, first of all, the 17-piece big band. It's the Carnegie Hall big band, and the nucleus of the players are from New York and are the finest musicians, great, great jazz musicians. And so the sound itself of this band and these players is spectacular. The visual element is, indeed, there are a lot of photographs and pictures of sheet music and performers, and there are film clips and such. So that is in confluence with some of the anecdotes I tell. It's not linear in the sense that it's sort of freewheeling, but I have a form to it, but it's not sort of like and then, and then, and then. It has an emotional through line. When I program a concert, I think in terms of like a dramatic play. Like when I do a bunch of songs that may seem to the audience unrelated, for me they have an emotional through line where it tells a story that has an arc of up-tempo and ballads and such. So I do that with Tony. I try and touch on the different aspects of his life through the music and through a gentle anecdotes and humor, because it was a very, very large and long career. And so I try to evoke a sense of the different aspects of what made him who he is.
Just the way you look tonight. Just the way you look to.
I'm David Fleming with you for KVC Arts in conversation with Michael Feinstein in the area quite soon with the music of Tony Bennett. Now, Michael, among your exploration and presentation of the Great American Songbook over the last 3 decades or so, we've gotten, of course, some Gershwin, and I want to ask about Ira Gershwin in a bit, but first, something I read earlier, but I think I glossed over a portion of it. You started piano at an early age, around 5, much like many kids starting early. But I just picked up on the fact that this is not when you started taking piano lessons. This was when you walked in and started playing by ear?
That's correct. Yes, I literally sat down and played the piano when I was 5. My parents had just bought a piano. Actually, my father pushed for it. My mother objected to it because they only had about $500, and we'd moved into a new home in Columbus, Ohio, where I grew up, and they didn't have money to buy furniture and a piano. And my father said, let's get a little upright piano. And my mother said, we need furniture. But somehow my father prevailed, and they bought this upright. And after it was delivered, I sat down and started playing with both hands instantly. My mother was sure that somebody had taught me how to do that and accused me of lying when I told her that I made it up or figured it out on my own. And they realized shortly thereafter that I was not lying and that I could play the piano. And so it was instantaneous that I had that ability.
That's very incredible. I mean, many of us, whether or not we ever went on to continue any sort of musical training, a lot of us can pick out, maybe on the right hand, well, or left if you're that type, picking out a melody. But to be able to do bass clef, left hand, treble clef, right hand, to actually be able to do that, that's incredible. So I suppose you were immersed in lessons after that.
No.
No.
They sent me for lessons. I took lessons for about 6 weeks. And the teacher, she played the exercise and put the music in front of me, and I would play it. And after about 6 weeks, one day, she put the music in front of me and said, let's do the next exercise. And I said, well, I can't. She said, well, just look at the music. I said, I can't. She said, why not? I said, well, you have to play it for me. And then she realized that I was listening to her play it, and then I would copy it. And so my mother was waiting in the hall, and she went to my mother and said, Mrs. Feinstein, do you realize that your son is playing by ear? And my mother said, yes. And she said, did you not realize? She said, no. And at that point, I said, I don't like lessons. I don't want to do lessons. So I stopped the lessons, and I just kept playing by ear. There were a few times through my formative years that I went and had more lessons. One was with a teacher, Miss Cook, who taught me chord substitutions, which was the most valuable thing I ever learned. But I've never learned to read music properly, and I feel, in the eyes of a very well-trained musician, faking it.
Wow. I would not have guessed with you, conducting this or that, or self-accompanying on, say, Feinstein Sings Gershwin, for example. There's a segue if I ever wrote one myself. Let's jump ahead. You ended up moving to L.A. and introduced to Ira Gershwin. You may have just been 20 or 21 at the time, if I did my math right. Tell me about how this, I don't know if it was a chance encounter or a coveted appointment. Tell us about how you ended up connected to Ira Gershwin, please.
I had moved to Los Angeles when I was 20 years old in the fall of 1976. I had just turned 20. And I was a record collector. I collected old 78 RPM records. And being in Hollywood at that time was amazing because there were quite a few used record stores. And I was like a kid in a candy store because being Hollywood, I was finding all sorts of unusual things related to the entertainment industry. And I had been collecting not only Gershwin recordings, having discovered Gershwin when I was in my teens, but also the recordings of Oscar Levant, considered to be the greatest interpreter of the Gershwin canon. And there were a few recordings by Oscar Levant that I could never find in Ohio. And I went into a record store on Highland Avenue, which was called The Record Collector, and asked if they had these particular rarities by Levant. The guy said, no, I don't have those, but I have these records that belonged to him. And he showed me a cache of private recordings, things I'd never seen before. I didn't know what air checks were or acetates or soundtrack playback discs. I didn't know what any of those were, but I discovered them all in this collection that had belonged to Oscar Levant, and I borrowed $150 from my parents to be able to buy these records. And they were extraordinary. They dated back to 1934. Air checks of Levant playing the Gershwin Concerto on radio and all kinds of extraordinary treasures. And the guy said he had gotten them from an auction of the Levant estate. And at that same time, I was working as a piano salesman in Los Angeles, trying to find my way, figuring out what I was going to do. And the lady who was the secretary at the piano store knew agents at William Morris, who used to represent Oscar Levant, and she got me the phone number of Oscar Levant's widow, June Levant. And I called her up out of the blue and introduced myself on the phone and said I had these records. And she invited me over to her home, and we became friends. And eventually, she introduced me to Ira and Leonore Gershwin, who asked me to start working for them less than a year later. And so it was an extraordinary series of coincidences that led me to Ira Gershwin, who was 80 years old when we met in the summer of 1977, and I was 20, so there was a 60-year age difference, but we got on amazingly because I already was well-schooled in Gershwin, having read all the books and heard recordings, and he was amazed that there was a 20-year-old kid who spoke his language. So it was a fortuitous experience, to put it mildly.
Oh, I would say so. I read that while you were working as Gershwin's assistant for some 6 years, there were several unpublished Gershwin songs, many of which you've since performed and recorded. I think the term unearthed was used. Did Ira share these with you, or was this something really cool, like you discovering a notebook in a hidden compartment somewhere, some really cool Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew stuff?
It was a combination, really.
Ooh.
Ira had a box of unpublished Gershwin melodies, which he considered to be extremely important because they were the last substantial things that George had written that were not known to the public. And there was a gentleman named Al Cohn who worked for Warner Brothers Publishing, who largely controlled the Gershwin catalog. And he would come over and we would go through these unpublished songs. So we would play through them. And Ira had considered releasing a bunch of them in the 1960s for a ballet project and then a recording project with Andre Kostolanitz. But he never could bring himself to do so because he wanted the release of these unpublished tunes to be momentous. He wanted them to be connected to some project or a show or a film or some major release of them, because otherwise if you just put a song out there, one piecemeal, they're not going to get any attention. So he understood that they had to be in a context that would present them in their best light, but that also prevented him from putting them out there all those years. So they remained obscure. But I sometimes would go through some of the other boxes and files of Gershwin, and in a few instances I found music for which there were no lyrics, and actually later found the lyrics that went with the music, and thus married once again the two elements that had been lost. There's one song that Ira wrote with George for Lady Be Good, 1924, one of their earliest collaborations, called Leave It to Love. And Ira could never find the lyric. The melody was there, and we played through it quite often, but the lyric never turned up, and it always drove him crazy that he couldn't find the lyric. So things disappear through the years.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Oh, that is too cool, Michael. Wow. You mentioned being exposed to, or first maybe hearing some Gershwin as a teenager. I suppose I probably knew the song Summertime, okay, long before I knew who any Gershwins were. And then it was working in jazz and other public radio offerings that I became aware of Porgy and Bess. And so, do you remember the first Gershwin tune that, not necessarily that you heard, but the first one that really moved you? Whether it's moved you to finally look at the liner notes, or moved you with some poignant statement that Ira put on top of George's works. Any form of this being struck by a tune or lyric.
The first Gershwin piece that moved me deeply, like many, was Rhapsody in Blue.
I
was visiting some friends of my parents who lived down the block from us in our neighborhood, and they had a huge record collection, and I discovered Rhapsody in Blue and started listening to it, and I had a visceral experience, a feeling in my body I'd never had before. Even though I was in my teens, that music was far more moving to me and significant than anything I heard on the radio. And so I had to find everything I could written by Gershwin, and then I later discovered the songs. I did see the movie, the film biography of George, released in 1945, called Rhapsody in Blue.
Yes.
Which is not very accurate or true to the real life, but the musical performances were extraordinary because the film was actually made in 1943, even though it wasn't released until 45. And so it was only produced 6 years after George's death, and so many people who had worked with him were in the film, and so the performances were certainly authentic. And that introduced me to the larger Gershwin catalog.
All right, wow. One that was on Porgy and Bess, but then removed from Porgy and Bess, but you have it included on one of your Gershwin discs, and that is the song Lonely Boy.
Lonely Boy, yeah.
Yeah, I did some reading on this, and I understand that it was originally in place in Porgy and Bess, but then removed, and then they did a reprise of Summertime instead. And then Ira at some point insisted that Lonely Boy not go back into Porgy and Bess. Do you know anything more about this? I'm sure that there were conversations, whether it was this one or other tunes, that Ira had to have spoken with you about, that for anybody else, it would be just a really cool behind-the-scenes, can't-read-it-elsewhere kind of moment.
Porgy and Bess was very important to Ira. It is considered today the greatest American opera created. And Ira didn't want people monkeying with it. He didn't want them making changes from George's vision, because George conceived the piece, took him a long time to write it. And sadly, for the first performance, there were many cuts that had to be made for time because he overwrote. But it wasn't until the 1970s that it was produced in its entirety without the cuts. And that was very important to Ira. Even though it is a long evening, it's very rich musically, filled with so much inspiration, enough for several lifetimes, I think. And Lonely Boy was cut before it was even orchestrated. So it was out of the opera early on, and it was not intended to be in the opera. And when word got out that the thing had been written by George and was a cut section from Porgy and Bess, several people wanted to repatriate it into the opera, and Ira was very upset at the thought of that. So much so that even though he had Lonely Boy in his possession, he would never give it to anybody for fear that they would put it back in Porgy and Bess. after his passing, Eric Kunzel and the Cincinnati Pops made a recording of the entire suppressed scene that included Lonely Boy. It had to be orchestrated anew because George never orchestrated it. But during Ira's lifetime, Ira didn't even realize that George had written the entire scene. He just had the single song. And somebody had the lyric, but not the music. And he said, under no circumstances are you to give it to anybody. But recording Lonely Boy unto itself, which I did a number of years after Ira passed, was something that would not create the opportunity to put it in Porgy and Bess because it was just a one-off song.
Yeah.
But nobody has tried to reinsert the entire scene into the opera. I don't think the family would allow it. One other note about Porgy and Bess is that George realized it was too long, and the original production that happened on Broadway was one that had cuts that were made in the heat of the preparation of the opera, and he had always intended to go back and rework Porgy and Bess to make it more manageable lengthwise, and he would have reinserted things like the Buzzard Song, which were cut from the original production. So when people say that the full uncut version is definitive or the cut version that was done on Broadway is definitive, there is no definitive version because Gershwin died before he could create what he would have considered to be definitive.
Oh, wow.
God didn't mean you to cry, so go off to sleep. I'll always keep the sunshine and bright in your sky.
For this edition of KVCR Arts, I've been speaking with Michael Feinstein in the region soon with Because of You, my tribute to Tony Bennett at the McCallum Theater, March 1st, then down to San Diego on the 2nd. More at michaelfeinstein.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVCR Arts. Thanks again to Michael Feinstein, and here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Sandy Hodela, Zach Mays, and Shireen Awad. Many past KVCR Arts can be found through iTunes, NPR One, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. More events in the region can be found at kvcrnews.org/calendar. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR Arts, Behind Us Now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.